So continue with these aspects of insight and continuing on in particular with the theme yesterday of views. This is from the Sutta Nipata and Dr. Saritisa's translation. This is the chapter 8's fifth sutta in chapter 8, Parlamattaka Sutta. The person abiding by a certain dogmatic view, considering it is the highest in the world, claims, this is the most excellent, and disparages other views different from that as inferior. As a result, he is not free from disputes. When he sees personal advantages from the things he has seen, heard, or cognized, or from rule or right, he clings passionately to that alone and sees everything else as inferior. The experts say that it is a bond to depend on what one associates with and to see everything else as inferior. Therefore, the disciplined one should not trust in things seen, heard, or felt, or in rules and rites. A disciplined person does not engender dogmatic views in the world, either by knowledge or by rule or right. Therefore, he does not consider himself superior, inferior, or equal. The sage has abandoned the notion of self or ego and is free from clinging. He does not depend even on knowledge. He does not take sides in the midst of controversy. He has no dogmatic views. For him, there is no desire to strive for this or that in this world or the next. He has ceased to associate with dogmas, for he no longer requires the solace that dogmas offer. To the sage, there is not the slightest prejudiced view with regard to things seen, heard, or felt. How can anyone in the world characterize by thought such a pure one who does not dogmatically grasp any views? They neither form any particular dogma nor prefer anything. Dogmatic views are not esteemed by them. The Brahman is not led by rule and right. Thus, the steadfast one has gone to the further shore, never more to return. This next sutta is also from the Sutta Nipata, from the chapter of the eights, sutta number 11. And this is Ajahn Dinisaro's translation. From where have there arisen quarrels, disputes, lamentation, sorrows, along with selfishness, conceit, and pride, along with divisiveness? From where have they arisen? Please tell me. From what is dear there have arisen quarrels, disputes, lamentation, sorrows, along with selfishness, conceit, and pride, along with divisiveness. Tied up with selfishness are quarrels and disputes. In the arising of disputes is divisiveness. Where is the cause of things dear in the world, along with the greeds that go about in the world? And where is the cause of the hopes and fulfillments for the sake of a person's next life? Desires are the cause of things dear in the world, along with the greeds that go about in the world. And it too is the cause of the hopes and fulfillments for the sake of a person's next life. Now, where is the cause of desire in the world? And from where have there arisen decisions, anger, lies, and perplexity, and all the qualities described by the contemplative? What they call appealing and unappealing in the world, in dependence on that desire arises. Having seen becoming and not becoming with regard to forms, a person gives rise to decisions in the world. Anger, lies, and perplexity, these qualities too, when that pair exists. A person perplexed should train for the path of knowledge, for it's in having known that the contemplative has spoken of qualities of dhammas. Where is the cause of appealing and unappealing? When what isn't, do they not exist? And whatever is meant by becoming and not becoming, tell me, where is its cause? Contact is the cause of appealing and unappealing. When contact isn't, they do not exist. And whatever is meant by becoming and not becoming, this too is its cause. Now where is the cause of contact in the world, and from where have graspings, possessions arisen? When what isn't, does mindness not exist? When what isn't, does mindness not exist? When what has disappeared, do contacts not touch? That's the question. Conditioned by name and form is contact. In longing, do graspings, possessions have their cause. When longing isn't, mindness doesn't exist. When forms have disappeared, contacts don't touch. For one arriving at what does form disappear? How do pleasure and pain disappear? Tell me this. My heart is set on knowing how they disappear. One not percipient of perceptions, not percipient of aberrant perceptions, not unpercipient, nor percipient of what's disappeared, for one arriving at this, form disappears. For complication classifications, that's papancha sankhara, proliferations and their attendant complications. For complication classifications have their cause in perception. What we have asked, you have told us. We ask one thing more. Please tell it. Do some of the wise say that just as much as the utmost, the purity of spirit is here, or do they say that it's other than this? Some of the wise say that just as much as the utmost, the purity of the spirit is here. But some of them, who say they are skilled, say it's the moment with no clinging remaining, knowing. Having known they still are dependent, the sage ponders dependencies. On knowing them, released, he doesn't get into disputes, doesn't meet with becoming and not becoming. He's enlightened. I thought I'd read Dr. Saratisa's translation of these series of questions and answers, some of them, the last ones. Sometimes Tanjaf is a bit more precise, but a little less user-friendly. Okay. I'll just start from, I'll read the whole thing so you get it in context again. It doesn't hurt. And this is the Kalaha Vivada Sutta, disputes and contention, the causes of anger and attachment. Sutta number 11. Sir, said a questioner, whenever there are arguments and quarrels, there are tears and anguish, arrogance and pride and grudges and insults to go with them. Can you explain how these things come about? Where do they all come from? The tears and anguish that follow arguments and quarrels, said the Buddha, the arrogance and pride and the grudges and insults that go with them are all the result of one thing. They come from having preferences, from holding things precious and dear. Insults are born out of arguments, and grudges are inseparable from quarrels. But why, sir, do we have these preferences, these special things? Why do we have so much greed? And all the aspirations and achievements that we base our lives on, where do we get them from? The preferences, the precious things, said the Buddha, come from the impulse of desire. So too does the greed, and so too do the aspirations and achievements that make up people's lives. From where, sir, comes this impulse of desire? From where do we derive our theories and opinions? And what about all the other things that you, the wanderer, have named, such as anger, dishonesty, and confusion? The impulse of desire arises when people think of one thing as pleasant and another as unpleasant. That is the source of desire. It is when people see that material things are subject both to becoming and to disintegration that they form their theories about the world. Anger, confusion, and dishonesty arise when things are set in pairs as opposites. The person with perplexity must train himself in the path of knowledge. The recluse has declared the truth after realization. But why, sir, is it that we find some things pleasant and some unpleasant? What could we do to stop that? And this idea of becoming and disintegration, could you explain where that comes from? It is the action of contact, of mental impression, that leads to the feelings of pleasant and unpleasant. Without the contact, they would not exist. And, as I see it, the idea of becoming and disintegration also comes from this source, from the action of contact. So what, sir, does this contact come from? And the grasping habit, what's the reason for that? Is there anything that can be done to get rid of possessiveness and anything that could be eliminated so that there would be no more contact? Contact exists because the compound of mind and matter exists. The habit of grasping is based on wanting things. If there were no wanting, there would be no possessiveness. Similarly, without the element of form, of matter, there would be no contact. What pursuit leads a person to get rid of form? And how can suffering and pleasure cease to exist? This is what I want to know about. There is a state where form ceases to exist, said the Buddha. It is a state without ordinary perception and without disordered perception and without no perception and without any annihilation of perception. It is perception, consciousness, that is the source of all the basic obstacles. Sir, you have explained to us everything we have asked you about. There is one more question we would like you to answer for us. Do the learned scholars of the world say that this is the highest purification of the individual being, or do they say that there is some other kind of goal? There are scholars and authorities, replied the Buddha, who say that this is the highest and the purification of the individual. There are others who maintain that the highest purity is to be found in the complete eradication of the five components of the person. And there is also the Muni, the wise being. He has realized which things are dependencies, and he knows that these are only crutches and props. And when he has realized this, he has become free. He does not enter into arguments, and so does not enter the round of endless becomings. Okay, the next sutta is Anguttara 3, 128. Friendly discussion between friends. Now the Venerable Anuruddha went to see the Venerable Sariputta. On coming to him, he greeted him courteously, and after the exchange of greetings and courtesies, sat down at one side. So seated, the Venerable Anuruddha said this: Here in this world, friend Sariputta, with the Deva sight purified and surpassing that of men, I can see the thousandfold world system. Strenuous and unshaken is my energy. Mindfulness is set up in me untroubled. My body is calmed, not perturbed. My mind is collected, one-pointed. Yet for all that, my heart is not released from the asavas without grasping. Well, Anuruddha, as to your statement about seeing the thousandfold world system, that is just your conceit. As to your statement about being strenuous and unshaken and so forth, that is just arrogance. As to your statement about your heart not being released from the asavas, that is just worrying. It would indeed be well for the Venerable Anuruddha if he were to abandon these three conditions, if he were not to think about them, but were to focus his mind on the deathless element, the Amrita Dhatu. So later on, the Venerable Anuruddha abandoned these three conditions, paid no attention to them, but focused his mind on the deathless element. And it came to pass that the Venerable Anuruddha, living alone, secluded, earnest, ardent, and aspiring, in no long time attained the goal supreme of the holy life, for which clansmen rightly go forth from home to the homeless. Even in this very life he himself, by his own intuitional powers, realized it, and having attained it, dwelt therein, for he knew birth is destroyed, lived is the holy life, done is the task, for me there is no more of being thus. And the Venerable Anuruddha was yet another of the Arahants. It's from the PTS translation, old. It's a bit clunky, but it's I couldn't find another one. I'm not sure why nobody else has translated that. It's a priceless sutta. Okay, the next sutta is Anguttara 4, 24, and this is the Tathagata being such, so you're not taking a stand. Bhikkhus, whatsoever in the world with its gods, Maras and Brahmas, recluses and Brahmins, celestial and human beings, whatever is seen, heard, sensed, cognized, attained, sought after, and pondered by the mind, all that I know, all that I have fully understood, all that is known to the Tathagata, but the Tathagata has not taken his stand upon it. If I were to say, Bhikkhus, whatever in the world is seen, heard, sensed, cognized, attained, sought after, and pondered by the mind, all that I do not know, that would be a falsehood in me. If I were to say, I both know it and do not know it, that also would be a falsehood. If I were to say, I neither know it nor am ignorant of it, that also would be a fault in me. Thus, bhikkhus, a Tathagata does not conceive a visible thing as apart from sight. He does not conceive of an unseen. He does not conceive of a thing worth seeing. He does not conceive about a seer. He does not conceive of an audible thing as apart from hearing. He does not conceive of an unheard. He does not conceive of a thing worth hearing. He does not conceive about a hearer. And then the same with the sensed and the cognized. Thus, bhikkhus, the Tathagata, being such in regard to all things seen, heard, sensed, and cognized, is such. Tata. Moreover, there is no one greater nor more excellent than one who is such, I declare. And it ends in verses. Whatever is seen, heard, sensed, or clung to is esteemed as truth by other folk. Among those who are entrenched in their views, being such, I hold none as true or false. I saw this hook well in advance, on which humanity is hooked and impaled. It is just as I see and know it. Tathagatas have no such clinging. Okay. Next is a succinct little sutta on the middle way. And particularly in terms of effort. This is the first discourse of the Devata Sanyutta, which is Sanyutta 1. Thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One was dwelling at Savati in Jetas Grove, Anathapindika's park. Then, when the night had advanced, a certain Devata of stunning beauty illuminated the entire Jetas Grove, approached the Blessed One. Having approached, he paid homage to the Blessed One, stood to one side, and said to him, "How, dear sir, did you cross the flood?" "By not halting, friend, and by not straining, I crossed the flood." Flood is the oka, I think it's, and that's the orcas, the flood of sensuality, flood of becoming, flood of views, and the flood of ignorance. And it's the similar to asavas, but with the views included. But how is it, dear sir, that by not halting and by not straining, you cross the flood? When I came to a standstill, friend, then I sank. But when I struggled, then I got swept away. It is in this way, friend, that by not halting and by not straining, I cross the flood. So the footnote on that says, the Buddha's brief reply points to the middle way, Macchima Patibhata, in its most comprehensive range, both practical and philosophical. To make this implication clear, the commentary, or sub-commentary, commentary enumerates seven dyads. One, halting by way of defilement, one sinks. Straining by way of volitional formations, one gets swept away. Two, by way of craving and views, one sinks. By way of the other defilements, one gets swept away. Three, by way of craving, one sinks. By way of views, one gets swept away. Four, by way of the eternalist view, one sinks. By way of the annihilationist view, one gets swept away. Five, by way of slackness, one sinks. By way of restlessness, one gets swept away. Six, by way of devotion to sensual pleasures, one sinks. By way of devotion to self-mortification, one gets swept away. Seven, by way of all unwholesome volitional formations, one sinks. By way of all mundane, wholesome volitional formations, one gets swept away. And this is a short sutta, Anguttara 10, sutta number 7. Sariputta, talking about his attainment, looking through the veil. Once the Venerable Ananda approached the Venerable Sariputta and asked, "Can it be, friend Sariputta, that a monk attains such a concentration of mind that in earth he is not percipient of earth, nor in water is he percipient of water, nor in fire, nor in air, nor is not percipient of the base of the infinity of space, base of concentration of the base of infinity of space, he is not percipient of that base, and similarly, concentration of mind that in the base of infinity of consciousness, he is not percipient of the base of the infinity of consciousness, the base of nothingness, the base of neither perception nor non-perception. Nor is he percipient of this world or a world beyond, but yet he is percipient. Yes, friend Ananda, he can attain to such a concentration of mind. But how, friend Sariputta, can a monk attain to such a concentration of mind? Once, friend Ananda, I lived here in Savatthi in the dark forest. There I attained to such a concentration of mind that in earth I was not percipient of earth. And then through all of that, the material bases, and then the immaterial basis of concentration, and then neither percipient of this world or a world beyond. And yet I was percipient. But what was Venerable Sariputta percipient of on that occasion? Nibbana is the cessation of becoming. Nibbana is the cessation of becoming. One such perception arose in me, and another such perception ceased. Just as, friend Ananda, from a fire of faggots one flame arises and another flame ceases, even so, Nibbana is cessation of becoming. Nibbana is cessation of becoming. One such perception arose in me, and another such perception ceased. On that occasion, friend, I perceive that Nibbana is the cessation of becoming. That's an interesting perception to be playing with in terms of as one's practicing and sitting, just watching cessation of becoming and coming to that, letting that, and then seeing the of course, the movement of mind desperately trying to become, working with that, undermining, cutting that tendency to bhava and becoming, being. Next sutta is Majjhima 106, The Way to the Imperturbable. Thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One was living in the Kuru country, the town of the Kurus named Kamasadamma. There, the Blessed One addressed the bhikkhus thus, "Bhikkhus, Venerable Sir," they replied. The Blessed One said this, "Bhikkhus, sensual pleasures are impermanent, hollow, false, deceptive. They are illusory, the prattle of fools. Sensual pleasures here and now, and sensual pleasures in lives to come. Sensual perceptions here and now, and sensual perceptions in lives to come. Both alike are Mara's realm, Mara's domain, Mara's bait, Mara's hunting ground. On account of them, these evil, unwholesome mental states, such as covetousness, ill will, and presumption arise, and they constitute an obstruction to a noble disciple in training here. Therein, bhikkhus, a noble disciple considers thus, sensual pleasures here and now, and sensual pleasures in lives to come, and so on, constitute an obstruction to a noble disciple in training here. Suppose I were to abide with a mind abundant and exalted, having transcended the world and made a firm determination with the mind. When I do so, there will be no more evil, unwholesome mental states such as covetousness, ill will, and presumption in me. And with the abandoning of them, my mind will be unlimited, immeasurable, and well developed. When he practices in this way and frequently abides thus, his mind acquires confidence in this base. Once there is full confidence, he either attains to the imperturbable now, or else he resolves upon it with wisdom. On the dissolution of the body after death, it is possible that this consciousness of his leading to rebirth may pass on to rebirth in the imperturbable. This bhikkhus is declared to be the first way directed to the imperturbable." So that be the formless realms. Again, bhikkhus, a noble disciple considers thus, "There are sensual pleasures here and now, and sensual pleasures in lives to come. Sensual perceptions here and now, and sensual perceptions in lives to come. Whatever material form there is, all material form is the four great elements, and the material form derived from the four great elements." I guess that would be the previous one would be jhana that is in the form realm, fourth jhana. "When he practices in this way and frequently abides thus, his mind acquires confidence in this base. Once there is full confidence, he either attains to the imperturbable now, or else he resolves upon it with wisdom. On the dissolution of the body after death, it is possible that this consciousness of his leading to rebirth may pass on to rebirth in the imperturbable. This bhikkhus is declared to be the second way directed to the imperturbable." Again, bhikkhus, a noble disciple considers thus, "Sensual pleasures here and now, and sensual pleasures in lives to come. Sensual perceptions here and now, and sensual perceptions in lives to come. Material forms here and now, and material forms in lives to come. Perceptions of forms here and now, and perceptions of forms in lives to come. Both alike are impermanent. What is impermanent is not worth delighting in, not worth welcoming, not worth holding to. When he practices in this way and frequently abides thus, his mind acquires confidence in this base. Once there is full confidence, he either attains to the imperturbable now, or else he resolves upon it with wisdom. On the dissolution of the body after death, it is possible that this consciousness of his leading to rebirth may pass on to rebirth in the imperturbable. This bhikkhu is declared to be the third way directed to the imperturbable. Again, bhikkhus, a noble disciple considers thus. Sensual pleasures here and now and sensual pleasures in lives to come. Sensual perceptions here and now and sensual perceptions in lives to come. Material forms here and now and material forms in lives to come. Perceptions of forms here and now and perceptions of forms in lives to come. And perceptions of the imperturbable. All are perceptions. Where these perceptions cease without remainder, that is peaceful, that is the sublime, namely, the base of nothingness. When he practices in this way and frequently abides thus, his mind acquires confidence in this base. Once there is full confidence, he either attains to the base of nothingness now, or else he resolves upon it with wisdom. On the dissolution of the body after death, it is possible that this consciousness of his leading to rebirth may pass on to rebirth in the base of nothingness. This bhikkhu is declared to be the first way directed to the base of nothingness. Again, bhikkhu, a noble disciple, gone to the forest or to the root of a tree or to an empty hut, considers thus. This is void of a self or what belongs to a self. When he practices in this way and frequently abides thus, his mind acquires confidence in this base. Once there is full confidence, he either attains to the base of nothingness now, or else he resolves upon it with wisdom. On the dissolution of the body after death, it is possible that this consciousness of his leading to rebirth may pass on to rebirth in the base of nothingness. This bhikkhu is declared to be the second way directed to the base of nothingness. Again, bhikkhu, a noble disciple, considers thus. I am not anything belonging to anyone anywhere, nor is there anything belonging to me in anyone anywhere. And that's actually a sort of a alternative translation of that same, if I remember correctly, that is the that same verse that came up yesterday. When he practices in this way and frequently abides thus, his mind acquires confidence in this base. Once there is full confidence, he either attains to the base of nothingness now, or else he resolves upon it with wisdom. On the dissolution of the body after death, it is possible that this consciousness of his leading to rebirth may pass on to rebirth in the base of nothingness. This bhikkhu is declared to be the third way directed to the base of nothingness. Again, bhikkhu, a noble disciple, considers thus. Sensual pleasures here and now and sensual pleasures in lives to come. Sensual perceptions here and now and sensual perceptions in lives to come. Material forms here and now and material forms in lives to come. Perceptions of forms here and now and perceptions of forms in lives to come. Perceptions of the imperturbable and perceptions of the base of nothingness. All are perceptions. Where these perceptions cease without remainder, that is the peaceful, that is the sublime, namely, the base of neither perception nor non-perception. When he practices in this way and frequently abides thus, his mind acquires confidence in this base. Once there is full confidence, he either attains to the base of neither perception nor non-perception now, or else he resolves upon it with wisdom. On the dissolution of the body after death, it is possible that this consciousness of his leading to rebirth may pass on to rebirth in the base of neither perception nor non-perception. This bhikkhu is declared to be the way directed to the base of neither perception nor non-perception. When this was said, the Venerable Ananda said to the Blessed One, Venerable Sir, here a bhikkhu is practicing thus. It might not be, and it might not be mine. It will not be, and it will not be mine. what exists, what has come to be, that I am abandoning. Thus he obtains equanimity. Venerable Sir, does such a bhikkhu attain Nibbana? One bhikkhu here, Ananda, might attain Nibbana. Another bhikkhu here might not attain Nibbana. What is the cause and reason, Venerable Sir, why one bhikkhu here might attain Nibbana, while another bhikkhu here might not attain Nibbana? Here, Ananda, a bhikkhu is practicing thus. It might not be, and it might not be mine. It will not be, and it will not be mine. What exists, what has come to be, that I am abandoning. Thus he obtains equanimity. He delights in that equanimity, welcomes it, and remains holding to it. As he does so, his consciousness becomes dependent on it and clings to it. A bhikkhu Ananda who is affected by clinging does not attain Nibbana. But, Venerable Sir, when that bhikkhu clings, what does he cling to? To the base of neither perception nor non-perception. To the base of neither perception nor non-perception, Ananda. When that bhikkhu clings, Venerable Sir, it seems he clings to the best object of clinging. When that bhikkhu clings, Ananda, he clings to the best object of clinging, for this is the best object of clinging, namely the base of neither perception nor non-perception. Here, Ananda, a bhikkhu is practicing thus. It might not be, and it might not be mine. It will not be, and it will not be mine. What exists, what has come to be, that I am abandoning. Thus he obtains equanimity. He does not delight in that equanimity, welcome it, or remain holding to it. Since he does not do so, his consciousness does not become dependent on it and does not cling to it. A bhikkhu Ananda who is without clinging attains Nibbana. It is wonderful, Venerable Sir, it is marvelous. The Blessed One indeed has explained to us the crossing of the flood in dependence upon one support or another. But, Venerable Sir, what is noble liberation? Here, Ananda, a noble disciple, considers thus. Sensual pleasures here and now, and sensual pleasures in lives to come. Sensual perceptions here and now, and sensual perceptions in lives to come. Material forms here and now, and material forms in lives to come. Perceptions of forms here and now, and perceptions of forms in lives to come. Perceptions of the imperturbable, perceptions of the base of nothingness, and perceptions of the base of neither perception nor non-perception. This is personality as far as personality extends. This is the deathless, namely, the liberation of the mind through not clinging. Thus, Ananda, I have taught the way directed to the imperturbable. I have taught the way directed to the base of nothingness. I have taught the way directed to the base of neither perception nor non-perception. I have taught the crossing of the flood independence upon one support or another. I have taught noble liberation. What should be done for his disciples out of compassion by a teacher who seeks their welfare and has compassion for them, that I have done for you, Ananda. There are these roots of trees, these empty huts. Meditate, Ananda. Do not delay, or else you will regret it later. This is our instruction to you. That is what the Blessed One said. The Venerable Ananda was satisfied and delighted in the Blessed One's words.